hard freeze, which requires a temperature of 28 degrees or lower for at least 4 hours. Corn, bean, and squash growers in South Florida, though, are less optimistic, with some local farmers reporting losses, which could mean higher prices at the market. The record-setting cold weather that hit parts of Florida is easing up for a couple of days, but the state faces yet another cold front over the weekend. For NPR News, I'm Phil Latzman in Miami.
Hall of Fame pitcher Bob Feller has died at the age of 92. Feller is considered one of the greatest pitchers in baseball history. He was once asked what he considered the highlight of his career.
Probably the no-hitter in Yankee Stadium when I went in there and my first start in Yankee Stadium after 4 years in the Navy in World War II.
Feller had left baseball at the height of his career to serve in World War II. He remained in good health until fairly recently. He once said that he had lived a blessed life. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Mid-Atlantic Arts Foundation in conjunction with the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, funding the Jazz.Next project.
Hi, I'm Jim Meadows.
I'm Tom Rogers.
I'm Sean Powers.
And I'm Celeste Quinn. You listen to us on WILL Radio and TV, and now we want to listen to you. Every month, we're out in the community having conversations about your hopes and challenges. What we hear impacts the programs we produce. If you'd like to have a community conversation in your town, give us a call at 217-333-7300 or email willconnect@illinois.edu.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Community Blood Services of Illinois, providing all donated blood for patients in Champaign-Urbana, Charleston-Mattoon, Danville, and Effingham. Blood donation takes only 45 minutes and saves lives. Donation information at 367-2202 or on the web at bloodservices.org.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour today, we will be talking about the life of George Washington. And our guest is Ron Chernow. He is the author of a new biography. The title of the book is Washington, A Life. It's just recently been published by the Penguin Press. He says that in our desire to revere George Washington, we have sanded down the rough edges of his personality. He goes on to say that beneath his famously stoic reserve, there lurked a powerfully emotional man of many moods and fiery opinions. Chernow says that Washington was a real force of nature and not at all the bland figure that we may carry around in our heads. He says the furnace of his ambition was always burning. More about Washington as we talk with Ron Chernow. Just mentioned that he is the author of a number of books, including The House of Morgan, which won the National Book Award. His two most recent, a biography of Alexander Hamilton and also Titan, The Life of John D. Rockefeller, Sr. They were both nominated for the National Book Critics Circle Award in biography. And he's joining us this morning by phone. As we talk, questions are welcome. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. We also have the email, so if you'd like to send along your question that way, you can do that, will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, questions are welcome. We just hope people will be brief, but we welcome anybody's input, questions, comments, and to the program. And Mr. Chernow, hello.
Great pleasure to join you, David. Thank you.
Well, thanks for the time. I think that the problem here initially is that when people think of George Washington, they no doubt think of that guy who's on the dollar bill, who seems to be rather stern, reserved, unknowable. And I think that a lot of people might confess that they saw Washington as being the least interesting, the least compelling of all of the founding fathers. And I think that you are here to say, well, that's not what he was like at all.
Yeah, what I tried to do was to really get to that man behind the stoic and reserved facade that we know so well. And what I found during the 6 years that I worked on this book was a man who was passionate and complex and very sensitive and the tremendous emotional turbulence under the surface. But he was always at great pains to hide it. You know, one way in which George Washington was very different from the other founders all wanted to sparkle in the moment so that if an Alexander Hamilton or a Benjamin Franklin or James Madison walked into the room, you would know within seconds that you were in the presence of an extraordinary person, whereas George Washington was somewhat secretive and reserved and aloof. And his greatness, you see, not so much, you know, in what he, you know, said or did at any given moment, but these immense, monumental tasks that he achieves over long periods of time.
It seems that if for us Washington is this kind of bland or almost sort of blank personality, some of that has to do with Washington himself, because it seems that he was someone who was very concerned with how he was seen. He wanted to be taken seriously, and was very, I think now we would say that he was somebody who was very image conscious. Where did that come from?
Yeah, I spend a lot of time in the book on this. He turned out to be really a master showman with a tremendous sense of political stagecraft. I'll just give you a couple of examples. When he traveled between towns, he would travel by coach or carriage, but he always brought along a white parade horse. And outside of town, he would dismount from his coach. He would get on the white parade horse, and then he would magnificently ride into town, because that's how the public wanted to see him, General George Washington. Another equally amazing example is that during the Revolutionary War, he created his own personal guard to protect him. And here, on the one hand, he's complaining to the Congress of a shortage of manpower and money. On the other hand, he informs his officers that for his personal guard, he doesn't want anyone who is shorter than 5'8" or taller than 5'10". Well, a year later, he's not satisfied with that, and he issues new orders that to be a member of his personal guard, you can't be shorter than 5'9" or taller than 5'10". He wants this kind of bandbox precision. He was very, very image conscious. I guess that a psychotherapist would say that that was masking an enormous amount of anxiety or insecurity about this inner turmoil that I mentioned. Mm-hmm. But he, throughout his career, for instance, he not only designed his own clothing, he designed his own uniforms. Very image conscious and even fashion conscious.
Yeah. Well, and he certainly was. And when you see you see portraits of him when he was younger and attempts to reconstruct what he looked like, he was clearly a handsome man. He was athletic. He was very charismatic. He looked good in those uniforms. He rode well. He looked good on that white horse. And I'm sure that all of that helped to inspire confidence in his ability, and that had something to do with how it is that he became the general
Absolutely.
Of the Continental Army.
I'm glad you brought that up, because the image that we have of George Washington was really indelibly shaped by the Gilbert Stuart portraits of the final years of Washington's life. They were done in towards the end of the second term as president. And by that point, Washington was kind of stiff and craggy and stern and haggard. But if you look at the portraits that were done of him during the Revolutionary War, as you were saying, he was lithe and graceful and athletic. He was a great dancer. Thomas Jefferson said that he was the best horseman of the age. And so I think that what's gotten lost in translation to posterity was that he was, by his contemporaries, seen as a very exciting figure, a charismatic and heroic figure. And, of course, this was absolutely essential during the Revolutionary War, because it was part of his inspirational presence in keeping the Continental Army together in the face of 8.5 years of shortages of manpower, money, clothing, shoes, blankets, muskets, gunpowder, everything, so that the image was itself an important political statement.
Yeah, you also have to wonder the people around Washington, the other founders, were very distinguished and very able men, and you wonder whether there was a part of him that felt that he might not be equal to them.
Yes, I think so. Washington of the 7 or 8 major founders, Washington was the only one who did not go to university. And so his education was rather sketchy. And on occasions, he would refer to his defective education, so that there's no question that there was a kind of intellectual insecurity. What I discovered was he was an extraordinarily smart man. I dare say if he were a politician today, he would be considered a genius. But we inevitably compare him, with the Jeffersons and the Hamiltons and the Franklins, and so he doesn't seem to measure up. But he was not an original thinker, but he was exactly what we needed in a general and in a politician of that era, somebody who could latch on to original ideas and implement them. And I think that it's a testimony to Washington's self-confidence as a leader that he was never afraid to hire people smarter than himself. His first cabinet is really just 3 or 4 people, and it includes Alexander Hamilton as Treasury Secretary and Thomas Jefferson as Secretary of State in Washington, felt fully convinced that he could control these prima donnas, which he did with difficulty.
Yeah. Our guest this morning in this hour of Focus, Ron Chernow, and he is the author of a new biography of George Washington. It's just out, published by Penguin Press. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, will-talk at illinois.edu is the address for the email. I mentioned at the beginning that you had done a book on Hamilton, Alexander
right.
Hamilton, and apparently it was Hamilton, in a way, that helped kindle your interest in Washington or wanting to learn more about Washington. When
absolutely. You know, David, yeah. I can pinpoint the precise yeah. instant that I got interested in doing the Washington book. When I was researching Hamilton's life, Hamilton during the Revolutionary War was Washington's aide-de-camp. There came a moment where they had a feud that led to Hamilton quitting Washington's death. And Hamilton sat down and wrote a series of remarkable letters describing George Washington as a boss. And he said that Washington was moody and irritable and very temperamental. He wrote, "The great man and I have come to an open rupture. He shall for once at least repent of his ill humor." And I could remember sitting there absolutely stunned at this idea that Washington ill humor, the saintly father of our country, and Hamilton saw Washington as something of a powder keg boss, although he had tremendous admiration for him and, you know, saw the courage and the patriotism, the integrity, the wisdom, all of these other things. But still, Hamilton, because he worked with Washington on a daily, almost hourly basis, he saw all of this emotional turbulence under the surface, and that Washington, who was always carrying an enormous amount of political pressure, he was really carrying the hopes of the nation, he saw that Washington could be very irritable. And it's not at all surprising that Washington, given all the pressure he was under first as commander-in-chief during the war and then as the first president, it's not surprising that he periodically let off steam in a memorable way.
Mm-hmm. And Hamilton was not the only one to comment on this. If you read accounts of other people who knew him or saw him at work, there are other references to the fact that either that he had a temper or that he might have had outbursts of temper or that he was a man who could really be quite emotional and could at times display that emotion.
Yeah, you know, you bring up a very good point because, you know, what I found when I was researching the book, that people who only met Washington very briefly, who knew him very distantly, would describe him as a sort of, you know, bland, mild, genial personality. The people who really knew him well saw a completely different figure. So even Gilbert Stuart said that he said that if Washington had been born in the forest, he would have been among the fiercest of the savage tribes. His friend Gouverneur Morris, who famously wrote the preamble to the Constitution, said that Washington had boiling in his breast passions almost too mighty for the breast of men. Even Thomas Jefferson, who of course worked very closely with Washington, said that Washington was naturally high-toned, which in 18th century lingo meant irritable or high-strung. So that this was an emotional reality that Washington kept shielded from the public, and he had formidable self-control in public. But the people who really knew him well saw quite a different personality behind the surface. And, of course, he inspired a tremendous amount of respect and affection, but also a touch of fear, as a very powerful boss or leader tends to do.
Yeah, there was one very important relationship here that you write about, and it's something that's perhaps marked by lack of affection, and that is the relationship between George Washington and his mother.
Right. This is one of the big surprises. Washington's father died when George was 11, leaving him to the tender mercies of Mary Ball Washington. Mary Ball Washington, we don't have any statements of her expressing pride or pleasure in her remarkable son. She didn't seem to have attended the wedding of George and Martha Washington. She doesn't seem to have visited them at Mount Vernon, even though she was living in Fredericksburg, which was close by. And she was a very self-centered, very difficult woman. And late in the Revolutionary War, she does something really bizarre to try to humiliate her son, the commander-in-chief. She goes to the Virginia State Capitol in Richmond, and she files a special petition for emergency relief, hinting at poverty and intimating that she was being neglected by you-know-who. And Washington, I don't know that he was an affectionate son. She was a hard mother to feel affectionate toward, but he was a very dutiful and generous son in terms of money. But it was never enough for his mother. And I, you know, speculate about two things in the book. One, I say that probably the first formidable general that George Washington ever encountered was his own mother, and that it was in the course of trying to deal with her very kind of, you know, arbitrary and capricious moods that he developed this formidable self-control that became such a part of his personality.
Yeah, you would think that for any parent, if your son went on to become a general of the Continental Army and then first president of the United States, that would be something to be proud of. But that apparently, as far as his mother was concerned, that somehow just wasn't enough.
Yeah, I mean, if any mother in American history had things to brag about, it was Mary Ball Washington. But I think that because she had lost her husband when George was 11. George was the eldest of six children from that marriage. I think that she expected that George, as this very self-reliant, resourceful eldest son, should step into the father's footsteps. And she kind of never got past that and felt very envious and very kind of threatened by his career in some way.
Another key relationship clearly is his relationship with Martha Custis, who became Martha Washington, and someone who already she had been married, she had children, already was established, was a woman of means. And I think you suggest that for him, this was very important to his career.
Absolutely. I don't know that it was the greatest romance of the 18th century, but she brought a number of things to this marriage which made it an extremely not only happy but productive one for George Washington. She was the wealthiest widow in Virginia, if not the country, when they married, so it gave Washington a new level of financial security. Washington was a cordial host, but of a rather detached sort. Martha was very, very socially skillful. And Washington, you know, being somewhat emotionally repressed, needed an emotional confidant, and Martha served that function. You know, it was always said in the earlier biographies that Martha would visit him in his winter quarters during the Revolutionary War. Was what I discovered was that when you add it up, she actually spent a full half of the Revolutionary War with her husband, because those winter stays would lengthen into the spring. And this is quite a remarkable sacrifice from a woman who was very jittery being in a war zone. This required real effort on her part to stand by her man.
Mm. They never had children, although they really would have liked to?
They never had children. We know that there was sadness about that, because Washington referred to it, although from a political standpoint, the absence of children turned out to be an absolute bonanza for George Washington. The historical assumption, you know, then and now has always been that George Washington was sterile, since Martha had four children from the previous marriage. There were a lot of religiously minded people who felt that God had deliberately denied George Washington children so that he could function as the father of his country. I kid you not, this was widely said at the time. The other thing, perhaps even more important, was that when Washington became president, and there was a natural fear that the country would slide back into monarchy, people were reassured by the fact that Washington had no heirs, because they said he would have no self-interest in establishing hereditary monarchy or aristocracy, because he had no heirs. So it turned out, however sad that was for George and Martha, to be a lucky thing for his political career that they had no children.
He was born into certainly a wealthy family, maybe not at the very top tier of wealth at that time, but certainly who was born into wealth. When he was young, he worked to establish himself as a man of property and substance, what men of his class would naturally aspire to. What, though, is interesting, I think, is that he ends up devoting so much of his life, a full quarter century, to public service, both during the war and after. What do you think motivated that?
Well, you know, the interesting thing about this story is that Washington, as a young man, is very ambitious. He has remarkable courage and perseverance. He serves for 5.5 years in the French and Indian War. In fact, he is so precocious that at the age of 23, He's in charge of all of the armed forces in Virginia, which was the most powerful colony. But he's pursuing money, status, power. Then something very interesting begins to happen in the mid-1760s, starting with the Stamp Act and the Townshend duties and these other oppressive measures that the British enacted. Washington's grievances as a young man were very, very personal. He coveted a royal commission in the British Army, which he didn't get. He felt that these British merchants were selling him shoddy goods from London. The British banned settlement west of the Allegheny Mountains at a time when he was amassing real estate. So he has a whole list of personal grievances. Then, starting with the Stamp Act, he begins to realize that his personal grievances simply reflect this larger public problem, and that the deck is stacked against all of the colonists. And then suddenly he becomes a different and much grander figure and is really kind of ennobled in this cause. He had always been very, you know, interested in fame and public service. You know, people don't realize he'd been in the House of Burgesses for almost 20 years before the Revolutionary War. So he was always politically ambitious. He was always interested in the military. He said he was strongly disposed to arms. And so all of these impulses then suddenly, you know, coalesce when he becomes commander-in-chief of the Continental Army in June 1775.
We have a caller with a question. Let's talk with him in Urbana. Line one, hello.
Oh, a good snowy morning to you from us in Urbana here. We were inundated. I have a question about the song Yankee Doodle Dandy. I'm a musician and a folk song collector. And there's always been a controversy over the origin and derivative of this. We believe that it was a early British music hall spoof on George Washington. Of course, doodle means a phony, you know, somebody who pretends to be something else than what they are. And dandy, of course, needs no explanation. Do you have any enlightenment for me on this?
I confess I'm absolutely ignorant on that topic. I'm gonna look it up because you've now piqued my curiosity, but I'm afraid I really can't help you on that.
6 years of work, and and you can't answer that question?
People always ask you, you know, the one thing that you didn't research. So sorry about that.
All right. Well, other questions certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. And I think I do want to honor the amount of work that went into the project, because I know that you did work on this for many years, and that that perhaps you were helped by a greater volume of personal papers, material that you had to draw from that previous biographers didn't?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good point that people don't realize, you know, just how much work goes into this. One of the things that emboldened me to do yet another book, you know, about George Washington is that starting in the late 1960s at the University of Virginia, they began to create a new edition of George Washington's papers. Every year, another volume or two comes out. There are now 62 projected 90 volumes. And the editors of that project gathered together 135,000 documents, either written by George Washington to George Washington or prepared for George Washington. So it's a feast of scholarship. And we know so much about him. You feel like you could, you know, trail after him on an hourly basis. I dare say that we know more about George Washington than Martha did.
And again, this is some of this was at his own instigation, because he seemed to think that it was important that there be a record of what he did.
He thought that would be his legacy. That would be what would safeguard his fame for posterity. In fact, during the war, when there was a tremendous shortage of money, he asked Congress for a special appropriation so that they could hire a team of secretaries who do nothing for 2 years during the war but produce a beautiful edition of his wartime papers in 28 large bound volumes that Washington then takes back to Mount Vernon. In the final years of his life, he even considered creating a special building at Mount Vernon to house these letters, which would have been the first presidential library long before anyone had the idea of doing it. And so, yes, we owe it to George Washington himself that we have such a complete record. You know, on the other hand, George Washington could also be very secretive on certain topics. For instance, even though we know a fair amount about his difficult relationship with his testy mother, we scarcely know anything about what he thought about his father, who died when George was 11, and there are, you know, at most one or two sentences, you know, in all these 135,000 documents where George is talking about his father. And so sometimes you do a biography and the silences can still be very frustrating. Mm.
You know, I can't help mentioning that so many of the interviews that you've done, reviews, have made note of the heft of the book, and that people have said things like, you know, not only do we need a new biography of George Washington, but does it need to be this big? And I guess I just want to ask a kind of writer question.
Right.
That is, when you work on a project for such a long time and you amass an awful lot of material, how do you decide what details, what pieces of information are really most important, and those
question.
Things
you
that
know,
could be left by the wayside?
Yeah. You know, what I felt in doing this, I felt there had been a lot of good books written on George Washington in recent years, but what I noticed was that they were becoming both more frequent and at the same time less ambitious. So the year I started this, David McCullough did 1776, about a year in Washington's life, or David Hackett Fisher did Washington's Crossing, an event in Washington's life, or Joseph Ellis did His Excellency, which was a kind of thematic study of Washington's life. But nobody had done the big go-for-broke, cradle-to-grave, authoritative biography. So I really wanted this to be a book where people could open it up, you know, and almost any question that they had about George Washington would be answered. The book, yes, is admittedly long, but I felt that I was competing with the 7 volumes of Douglas Southall Freeman back in the 1940s and 1950s. That was 4,000 pages, where James T. Flexner in the 60s and 70s, that was 2,000 pages. So the narrative portion of my book is a little bit more than 800 pages. So I felt that, given the fact I was doing this, you know, authoritative life of Washington, I felt like I was writing on the back of a postage stamp, you know, and there are hundreds of different episodes here. So I had to try to write very economically, and the length of it comes from just, you know, Washington's life, particularly the final 25 years, is nothing less than the story of the creation of the United States of America. So it's a huge story.
Yeah. Our guest this morning is Ron Chernow. He is the author of Washington, A Life, published by the Penguin Press, just come out with a magnificent reproduction on the cover of The Portrait of Washington by Rembrandt Peale. This is Washington on the White Horse, looking very, very regal. And Ron Chernow has authored a number of books. His first, The House of Morgan, won the National Book Award. His two most recent, Alexander Hamilton and Titan, The Life of John D. Rockefeller Sr., both were nominated for the National Book Critics Circle Award in Biography. And he's joining us by phone. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And the email is will-talk@illinois.edu. I think when you we talked a little bit earlier about the fact that he was, particularly as a young man, was robust and athletic. When you look at his experiences in life, he had a lot of the kind of health problems that you might expect for a person of that time, and it was in enough fights so that you have to think that this man was extraordinarily lucky to actually have lived long enough to be a president and to have lived to the age that he did.
Yeah, no, well, you know, just on the military side, he seemed to have led a charmed life. There's one battle during the French and Indian War where he has two horses shot out from under him. He takes no fewer than 4 bullets in his clothing and hat without actually suffering a scratch in the process. And there was one Indian chief on the French side who was watching this, who told Washington years later that Washington seemed so immune to bullets that he was convinced that Washington had some kind of supernatural protection. But Washington is a very kind of, you know, tough, sturdy guy. By the age of 30, he has already survived smallpox, malaria, and dysentery. There are 2 episodes during his presidency where he nearly dies, once from pneumonia, once from some kind of tumor infection on his thighs. So it's amazing that he lives to 67. But, you know, in the 18th century, everyone was sick all the time, and neighborhoods were being swept by epidemics. And so if you live to 50, you were probably off and running to 70 or 80, which was true. Actually, you know, Washington lived to 67. But then the next four or five presidents, Adams, Jefferson, Madison, Monroe, they all live into their 80s. And in the case of John Adams, lives to 90.
Well, we have another caller in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Washington, I've really have found to be an intriguing figure. What do you think was his model of deportment? He put himself into public situations as an officer, as a politician, and yet, is there any evidence that he was ever challenged to a point where he confronted someone in a duel, or a duel was imminent? Was there?
Well, there was. Well, it's a good question. There was actually a local election very early on when Washington, I think, was still in his 20s, where he got into a heated argument with a man called William Payne, who actually knocked Washington to the ground. Washington got up and had to be physically restrained from fighting back. In the honor culture of the day in Virginia, Washington would have been expected to issue a challenge for a duel. And instead, the next morning, he sat down and he wrote a letter of apology for whatever he had said that had, you know, provoked this argument. So Washington did not believe in dueling, and he makes this clear later on. I think in terms of his model of deportment, you know, he had an older half-brother named Lawrence, and we haven't discussed. Lawrence married into the Fairfax family, which was the most powerful family in Virginia. They controlled more than 5 million acres of land, and the marriage of the older half-brother into the Fairfax family ushers Washington into this rather regal patrician world, and I think that he develops this very kind of, you know, aristocratic manner. He also, as a young man, we know that he copies out 110 rules of civility from this book. I'll just give you a couple of examples. It says that, you know, when you're at the table, you should not, you know, wipe your teeth with the tablecloth or with the fork or a knife, if you must, to use a toothpick. Another one says not to approach too closely to anyone when you're speaking to them, lest you bedew their face with spittle. So we could see him actually as a young man copying out these rules of civility and training himself in order to enter into what was called polite society.
Most interesting. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Other questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Perhaps you could talk some more about Washington as a general, as I think that you argue that while he certainly had military successes, that he you would have to say as a military strategist, he was not exceptional.
Yeah, I came to the conclusion that, you know, he was at best kind of a middling general, that he did, you're right, he lost more battles than he won during the Revolutionary War. But, you know, I argue that this is one of those rare cases in history where what a general does between battles is arguably more important than what he does on the battlefield, because, you know, we had only the Congress. There was no executive or a judiciary. So Washington is in many ways sort of the de facto, you know, president during the war. He has to answer to Congress. He has to answer to 13 state governors. So politically, this is very, very tricky situation. Just holding the Continental Army together is holding together the American nation. And he's dealing with not only all of the shortages that I was talking about before, but in the early stages, all of the enlistments expire every year. George Washington says that never in history, you know, has an army had to disband every December and then reconstitute itself anew every January in full view of the enemy. So he was dealing with extraordinary challenges as a general, but I think it's through his, you know, his clarity of vision and his tenacity of purpose and his inspirational presence, he manages to keep this ragged army together, and that is the ultimate objective, because he knows and everybody knows that until the French actually enter as our allies, there's really no way that the colonists former colonists, are going to defeat the British Empire, which is the mightiest military machine of the time.
When time came to select the individual who would be the first, who would stand to be the first president of the United States, was there any question that it would be him?
No, and it's a very good question because Washington was president of the Constitutional Convention. At the Constitutional Convention, there was a great deal of nervousness about creating a powerful executive branch because we had just fought a war against excessive executive power. You know, and it's always said that Washington's presence at the Constitutional Convention was important because the widespread assumption was that he would be the first president and that it really emboldened the delegates to create a more powerful office of the presidency. The job was his for the asking, and in fact, both times that he was elected president, he stepped down voluntarily at the end of the second term, but both times that he was elected president, he was elected by unanimous vote of the Electoral College, which I think we can safely say is a situation that will never happen again.
Mm. And when he became president the first time, he no doubt was not thinking about a second term. He wasn't apparently thinking even of fulfilling the first term.
What happens with Washington is during the Revolutionary War, which lasts 8.5 years, he only goes back to Mount Vernon once for 3 days. So at the end of the war, he's just longing for a little bit of privacy. He's pulled away from Mount Vernon for 4 months for the Constitutional Convention. He's then very reluctant to serve as president. And so he kind of makes a deal with himself and a few intimates that he will serve as the first president for a year or two, establish the legitimacy of the new government, and then he will step down. But, of course, what happened was that every time he was about to step down and let Vice President Adams take over, there was another crisis, and his cabinet would say, "You can't leave now." And this went on for 8 years. And I think by the end of the 8 years, I think he was very, very relieved to be giving up power. And then he only had 2 or 3 years after that before he died. Mm.
And even after he left the presidency and went home, it seemed that there were so many people that felt that he belonged to them, that people just, they wouldn't leave him alone.
No, they wouldn't leave him alone, yeah. And in fact, during the so-called quasi-war with France, when Adams was president, there was fear of a French invasion, and Adams turns to Washington to lead a new army. Washington, again, reluctantly agrees to it. So, I mean, this is both an inspirational story. It's also a somewhat sad story that George Washington becomes a form of public property. His entire life is dedicated and, to a certain extent, sacrificed to public service. One part of this story that fascinated me is that when he went back to Mount Vernon after the Revolutionary War, people had warned him that he was going to have a lot of visitors. That understated that, you know, thousands of people descended on Mount Vernon, and poor Washington was so polite. He would feed them for the night. He would house them. He would often be sitting with, you know, 10 or 20 people at dinner every night. So he, even at Mount Vernon, had no privacy. And the saddest line in his voluminous correspondence, June 1785, he writes in his diary, "I had dinner alone with Mrs. Washington today, which I believe is the first time since my return from the war." Well, he'd been back from the war for a year and a half, and this was the first time he had dinner alone with his wife. So it kind of gives you a sense of just what a captive he became of his own celebrity.
Well, let's talk with someone else here. Champagne, line one. Hello.
Perhaps the most eloquent statement Washington left to us was his farewell address. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that and why you think it lived on so long and guided American foreign policy.
Yeah, the farewell address still speaks to us. Again, the farewell address was not meant to be spoken. It was printed in all the newspapers at the time. And I think that it continues to resonate. You know, it still is read every year on the floor of the U.S. Senate, and it somehow is a message that has remained strangely timeless. It's a plea for national unity. Remember, Washington suffered during his presidency. There was a tremendous bitter partisan divide, not unlike what we have today. So the farewell address was a plea for national unity. It was also a plea to rise above partisan politics, and it was a plea to have a benign, civilized discourse. In fact, Washington says in it that when we, you know, dissent most sharply with each other on the issues, that's when we need to be most civilized in our discourse. And alas, this is a message that Americans need to be reminded of every generation, and it has kept the farewell address evergreen.
All right.
Thank you
for the question. We have about 10 minutes left. Let me just introduce again our guest, Ron Chernow. He is the author of a new biography, Washington, A Life, published by the Penguin Press. It's a biography of George Washington, out now. And if you'd like to read it, you can seek it out. And questions here, welcome to 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. And next is a caller in Belgium, the community line number 4. Hello.
Hello and good morning to you all.
Yes. Thank you.
I think you might have mentioned it just in passing earlier, but I haven't caught every moment of your show. The discussion about his land holdings along the Ohio and Kentucky. He was a substantial landholder, and as I understand, he had a lot of problems with people wanting to take his land without paying for it.
Yeah, you're exactly right. You know, Washington owned a lot of land. Land was a mania in the 18th century. I guess it still is. Mount Vernon was 8,000 acres, but Washington owned an additional 40 to 50,000 acres on the western frontier. You know, and what happened during the war was that it was very hard to maintain property rights out in what was called the Ohio country, you know, would be southwestern Pennsylvania, you know, parts of Indiana, parts of, you know, Ohio, parts of West Virginia. And there were enormous number of squatters, and there was very little kind of police presence to enforce contracts. And it's interesting that at the end of the Revolutionary War, here George Washington has devoted 8.5 years being away and leading the Continental Army. In September 1784, he gets on horseback and he actually rides out to his western properties and tries to get these squatters to, you know, pay rent or to negotiate some kind of settlement. And he has a lot of very angry confrontations with the settlers. And so Washington was always in a strange position because he saw early on that the country's destiny, you know, lay in expansion into, you know, the Midwest. Of course, the country stopped at the Mississippi at that time. At the same time, the Western settlers were very kind of, you know, rambunctious, and didn't respect a lot of the deeds and titles that counted heavily on the Eastern Seaboard, and so that those properties, you know, from a rental standpoint, were never as profitable as he had hoped.
Hello?
Yes.
Did he obviously must have sold them, or did they just, squatters just take them over and walk away with them?
You know, it depended. There were a lot of different situations. He did try to sell the land. He was always hoping that the land would appreciate more. You know, there was a real estate deflation at the end of the war, so he felt that he didn't want to sell these very large, you know, holdings at depressed prices.
I see. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. What are some of the ways that the character of the presidency and its traditions were really set by George Washington?
Well, this is extremely important because, you know, I mentioned that Washington was the president of the Constitutional Convention. You know, in Philadelphia, the delegates feel that the preeminent branch of government will be the Congress, however funny that sounds to us today. But Article 1 of the Constitution is devoted to the Congress because it was considered, you know, the people's house, and there's, as you know, a very, very long list of enumerated powers. Article 2, which is devoted to the presidency by design, was short, vague, very, very general. Washington, for 8.5 years during the war, had to deal with this eternally squabbling Congress. So when he becomes president, it's Washington who realizes that it's the president who will have to define the political agenda, both in domestic and foreign policy, and that Congress will then react to that agenda. This is something that every American now takes for granted, that the presidency, the executive branch, is the engine of government. But it was not a foregone conclusion, and Washington saw that there was something rather utopian about the idea that Congress would be, you know, capable of giving coherence and direction to policy. So we're still living with George Washington's legacy, and the legacy was so profound that we don't even see it. We just take it for granted. Mm.
That's I really think that that's an important point, that about how the framers thought of the branches of government,
yeah.
That we taught in civic class, you know, as you're coming up in school. There's these three branches of governments, and they're all supposed to be co-equal and check each other's power. And the fact of the matter is that at that point, the thought of the framers really was that the most important, the most powerful branch of the three was supposed to be the Congress.
Yeah, and that I guess that they had foreseen something, you know, that would be a little bit closer to sort of European parliamentary democracy. But we really have, you know, presidential government now, and Washington is president. No, he wasn't a lawyer. He deliberately for his cabinet chose people like Hamilton and Jefferson, you know, who were famous lawyers, because he realized he was going to have to apply and activate all of these different clauses of the Constitution. And he hasn't, there are a number of very kind of interesting test cases in terms of defining the separation of powers. At one point, he actually turns to the Supreme Court for some policy, you know, advice and opinions on foreign policy. And John Jay, who was the Chief Justice, writes back on behalf of the justices that this is inappropriate for the Supreme Court to be advising the president, and that this kind of violates the separation of powers. Washington also tries early on with a treaty with the Creek Indians. He goes to the Senate for their advice and consent, but the Senate, it's just so noisy and chaotic and disorganized that he gets up in a huff and he says, "This defeats every purpose of my coming here," and henceforth he trims advice and consent to simply consent. So, but he's, you know, he's trying very dutifully, very earnestly to implement the Constitution, but he begins to see that in certain ways it's not that workable.
And it's because Washington believed that no one should serve more than two terms, that all the way up until Franklin Roosevelt, no president did serve more than two
terms. Yeah, he didn't. You know, as I said, he had only wanted to serve one or two terms as president. He's relieved to step down after 8 years. I didn't find any statements, you know, where he said, you know, "I'm stepping down as a matter of principle because I think that no president should serve more than two terms." But what happened was that you know, willy-nilly, he had set a precedent, and you're right, it was a tradition of two-term presidency that was honored until Roosevelt was elected four times, and of course it was wartime conditions, it was rather extraordinary conditions, and then there was such alarm about that I think it was the 22nd Amendment, 1951, then constitutionally limits the presidency to two terms. But prior to that, it had just been, you know, the Washington two-term tradition that was honored as a custom.
We talked a little bit earlier about Washington and his health issues, and that he had kind of health problems you would expect for someone of that time.
Yeah.
We're now coming down to a couple of minutes, but I'm not sure I want to be the only interviewer not to bring up his dental issues.
Thank you, Dave.
Since it's both the kind of one of those things that people always think of, and actually you say that, well, you know, I think that's something that you really have to, in a way, have to take into account when you think about his conduct in public.
Yeah, no, absolutely, because what I discovered examining the dentures, he only had one tooth left when he became president. The teeth, to set the record straight, were not wooden. They were either elephant or walrus ivory. As the ivory cracked and stained and aged, it took on a grainy look that looked like wood. But an important discovery that I made examining the dentures was that in the back they were connected by curved metal springs. What that meant was that the only way that Washington could hold the dentures in his mouth was by keeping his lips firmly sealed, because every time that he opened his mouth to talk, there was always the possibility that the the dentures would come shooting out of his mouth. And so I point out in the book that, coincidentally or not, most of Washington's speeches as president were very, very brief. But it must have made this poor man enormously self-conscious in public. He was somebody that always, as we were talking earlier, he always prided himself on his appearance. And not only did he have to worry about the dentures slipping out, but he, in letters, wrote to his dentist how embarrassing it was that his the dentures made his lips bulge out and really kind of disfigured the face of a very good-looking man. So it's a sad story. And they would have been rubbing relentlessly against his gum, so he would have been in constant pain.
Yeah, it's that's perhaps why, at least perfectly, particularly in these later portraits, he has this sort of tight-lipped appearance, as almost as if he's really trying very hard to keep his
Absolutely.
Mouth closed.
You can see it. You can see it in the portraits, and you can see in the early portraits where he's smiling and how much more his face is relaxed and his whole manner, his whole body language, much more relaxed.
So now, just to end where we began with this idea that that people, it's difficult for people to see him as a living, breathing, passionate person. Do you think now, having gone through this long journey and spent so much time with him, that you feel about him as if he was a real person, a sense of who he would have been like and what it would have been like to be with him?
Oh, absolutely. You know, as I say, he was a deeply, deeply kind of, human and sensitive human being, very, very sensitive to all of the people that he dealt with. But, he was a man of his time. He was not a glad-handing, back-slapping politician. He was someone of tremendous, innate dignity in a rather patrician manner. And what I tried to do in the book, and it'll be up to readers to say whether I succeeded, is to give them a sense of that underlying man, who, as I start out by saying, was very passionate and very complex and deeply emotional, and not at all the bland or boring figure that has taken up residence in our imagination.
Well, having been through this big project generated this major work, is there anyone that you can think of that you would want to spend as much time on? Are you have some list of projects that you're thinking of moving on to?
I don't. Washington is a hard act to follow. Yeah. Kind of like you've scaled Everest and then you look around. There aren't that many peaks that high. The air gets a little bit thin up there, and so I've just been having so much fun going around talking about Washington, but at some point in the new year I will have to get on to another book. But no, I don't have a long list. I wish I did.
Our guest, Ron Chernow, he is the prize-winning author of 5 previous books. His first, The House of Morgan, won the National Book Award. 2 most recent, one on Alexander Hamilton and the other John D. Rockefeller Sr., they were both nominated for the National Book Critics Circle Award in biography. His most recent book is a biography of George Washington. The title is Washington, A Life, and it is published by the Penguin Press. It's out now in the bookstores. Mr. Chernow, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from the Meredith Foundation, dedicated to supporting the musical arts in performance and presentation.
Coming up in the next part of Focus 580, we'll explore some more of American history. Our guest will be David Kennedy. He is Emeritus Professor of History at Stanford, and we'll be talking about the period that has been come to be known as the Gilded Age in the late 19th century, and ask some questions about that time and this time and whether there are some parallels between the two. Right now, though, we'll take our usual break for an update on markets and news. Stay tuned.
Support comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at www.stuart-peterson.com.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets, where at mid-session, wheat is showing weakness at this hour, while corn has come off its lows to register some positive gains. And in the soybean pit, it's a mixed affair, with the nearbys showing weakness and the deferreds showing strength. Let's look at particulars in Kansas City March wheat. A high of 806.5, down 4.75. July, 820.75, down 3.5. March wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade, 754.75, down 10. July, 791, down 7.75. March corn, 586.25, up 2. May, 593.75, up 1.5. July, 597.75, up 1.75. December, 530.25, up 2.5.